Hello, I'm Lee Kimberg, a physician in the San Francisco Department of Public Health and the director of LEAP, here with our guest, Greg Merrill. Greg used to work at the UCSF Trauma Recovery Center, and he now teaches at the UC Berkeley School of Social Welfare. This past year, we had the wonderful opportunity to work with Greg on developing and delivering a training on vicarious traumatization to healthcare providers. We posted this training and all the materials that go along with it on the website at www.leapsf.org. That's www.leapsf.org, but thought this podcast would enrich your experience of using those training materials. Today, I am delighted to speak with Greg briefly about vicarious traumatization and how to use the training that Greg developed with LEAP. Welcome, Greg, and thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I wanted to tell you a funny story before we start our questions about these trainings. In a minute, you're going to explain to our listeners what vicarious traumatization is. Because it's a hard topic, we actually did, for some of our trainings, little gift bags for the participants. Mm-hmm. And in those gift bags, we had lots of little self-care tips and bath salts and even stuffed animals at one time.
Right.
And a bunch of my colleagues, when I told them about this podcast, told me that they actually still have those stuffed animals and that their children play with them and call them VT Bunny. And that they remember to sort of take a deep breath and calm themselves down whenever they hear about or see VT Bunny.
Okay.
The effects of the training and the gift bags lives on in their houses as well as at their work sites. Maybe you could start with first defining for our listeners, what are we talking about when we talk about vicarious traumatization, or some people say VT for short?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you asked me to design the training, I went in search of definitions that were useful, that would appeal to most people, and that would sort of explain the phenomenon to anyone. Actually, I think it was you who suggested that I look at Lori Perlman's work and Linda McKay's work, and they have a really simple definition. They call it the process of change. So the first thing that's important about the definition, it's a process of change that happens because you care about the people you serve. What I like about that is it's inevitable, and it comes from a good place because you care, and it's a process, meaning that even if it's inevitable, if it's a process, you can work with it, you can shape it. It's a process of change that occurs because you serve people who have been hurt and you care about them. Over time, the process can lead you to change. And it can lead you to change both in terms of your emotional well-being, your physical well-being, and your spiritual well-being. Those changes can, in turn, then affect not only you, but your family, the organization you work for, and the clients that you hope to help. It's basically a process of being, in a way, hurt or changed by your clients or your patients hurt. But it's quite hopeful in the sense that since the process is inevitable, the end result being negative is actually not inevitable. Mm-hmm. That there's a lot of hope around being able to work with that and shape that process and really author how that process affects you and how it doesn't. And so that's the definition that we used for this training.
I think that makes a lot of sense, especially the inevitability of it if you've gone into the profession to care about patients. So many patients in settings have so many hidden traumas that do come out in the healthcare setting where it's an intimate, confidential setting, and they can talk about things that have happened to them.
Yeah.
That they wouldn't talk about necessarily in other places. So I think it's a place where we're exposed to a lot of trauma.
Absolutely. If I may sort of elaborate,
sure.
too, that one of the things I learned in the training was that even when the patient wasn't talking about their trauma history, the provider could feel it in the room, could feel suffering, could feel hurt, could feel helplessness, could feel despair. Could feel frustration and rage too. And essentially, even without the patient communicating directly that what their trauma narrative or history had been, many of the doctors and nurses and other medical assistants felt that they were in trauma's emotional wake without the words around it. And so it's very, very powerful. Even if your patients aren't talking about it, their bodies tell a story, their emotional fields tell a story. And when you're in a room with them, you are still deeply touched, particularly if your heart is open, as it is in the case of many public health providers, that they come open-hearted to the work. And they feel in their body and in their emotional centers, they feel very much the suffering of the patient. But sometimes it's actually wordless, too.
Right. And actually, one of the settings in our health center, our small health center in inner city San Francisco, where that comes out the most actually is sometimes in the waiting room. So it's even the receptionists and the clerks who are checking patients in that experience a lot of the effects of the patient's trauma material.
Anybody who encounters the patient and is in the room with them or on the phone with them can have this emotional experience of vicarious trauma, especially at interpreters, because they're there interpreting and witnessing, not able to really do anything but interpret or translate, and they can be incredibly hurt as well. So every single allied health profession who's in a room or with a patient who's got a pretty complex trauma history is actually touched by that history and often doesn't know that they're being touched by the history. And so what I like about this definition is it brings it to light, gives people an opportunity to reflect upon it, to know that it's happening, to name it, and also to give them a sense of power and agency and how they work with that process of change.
You have a long and rich history working with trauma patients at the UCSF Trauma Recovery Center. And I was wondering if you could describe a little bit of your history of your work and how you came to feel that this was an important topic to address.
Before I worked at Trauma Recovery Center, I worked in a nonprofit for 8 years. And I have to say that, and I was dealing with all adult crime victims all the time, and I think it had a horrible effect on my mental and physical health, but I had no opportunity to reflect on that. Nobody was asking me about it. I wasn't necessarily talking about it because I just felt like there was something wrong with me. I would go home from work every single day emotionally and physically exhausted. I would often get takeout food and watch hours of TV and then go to bed and then start over again. This was very early in my career. And it became clear to me that that was not a sustainable way to do the work, even though I didn't have language for it or I didn't know what to do. When I began to work at the Trauma Recovery Center, what was wonderful about it was that the agency that I worked for created a language for it. There were psychologists there and other health professionals who knew a lot about vicarious trauma and introduced the topic very actively during new employee orientation or during our case conferencing or during our case discussion, that the topic was really a regular part of the conversation we had with each other. And then I began to reflect a lot more on how it was affecting me. One story that I will never forget, we all carry around these stories, and I won't go into details. One of the things about the training is I kind of encourage people not to share the gory details of their vicarious trauma because it just hurts other people. But I will suffice to say that I had been in the room of a patient who had a severe gunshot injury, and I saw things that were very disturbing to me. And I went home for the rest of the weekend, and I could think of nothing else. And I was too embarrassed about it to talk to my supervisor, who was actually the person who taught me about vicarious trauma. So even though she created a very welcome environment, I had so much sort of shame, like I shouldn't be having this reaction, I should be able to handle this by now, that it took me about another week or two to actually reflect on it with her. And then I began from that point forward to identify it sooner and to talk with it sooner. So just to say, I was through a several-year learning process of coming to recognize this was happening to me, it was changing me, and to come out of my hiding around it and to try to uncloak it and make it a more public conversation with the people I worked with.
And I think it's actually fairly rare in my experience that healthcare settings, especially ones that are not devoted fully to trauma clients, do incorporate training about vicarious traumatization. So that was obviously one of the reasons why we decided to develop this training for healthcare centers to use, especially healthcare centers that are seeing, you know, very vulnerable, underserved patients who have very strong trauma histories, lifelong trauma histories. Yeah. I think that was one of the reasons it was really important to work on this topic.
Absolutely.
To help people. So let's turn to the training and talk about designing the training and what you were hoping to achieve through doing a brief training on vicarious traumatization. Mm-hmm. And acknowledging that this was a very brief training. This is a training meant to be given only in 1 to 1.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite a challenge that we gave you to try and come up with mm-hmm. something that would be therapeutic for people in such a short period of time.
Well, I like challenges. That's part of what I've tried to do is the things that scare me. I sort of try to face them and be creative and resourceful with them. So when you asked me to develop a vicarious trauma training for healthcare providers that could be delivered in clinic settings during business meetings in 45 to 60 minutes, it was to some degree laughable at the time. But then I was like, I can do it and I can figure it out. And we can figure it out, more importantly, not just I, but we, meaning you and I, and also the clinics. As we piloted this, it was a collaborative, creative process. So a lot of trainers really need to work on editing down. You know, in 45 to 60 minutes, people are going to walk away with two things. And you just have to be really clear about what you'd like it to be. So I think what I came up with is for people, A, just to understand what vicarious trauma was, that it was an inevitable process of change. That was the first part. And the second part was for them to reflect on what that process of change had looked like for them, just sort of to self-assess. And then sometimes you can sneak in a third bullet point. And so sometimes I couldn't in the time frames. But the third really objective was, and what do you want to do about that? Given that this is happening, and given that it's going to continue to happen, and given that it's having these effects on you, where do you stand with that? And what would you like to do, or what do you need to do in the future to be able to hold yourself in this work the way you want to be? And I think to a lesser extent, the training was successful at the future focused, the coping focused. Mm-hmm. We were successful at getting people to spend a little bit of time knowing what this is and getting an internal pulse on where they stood with it. Those were really the main things, is to begin to initiate a conversation that people may continue and may not. That's not something we have control over, but they have an invitation to know at this one time.
And I think one of the things that was really unique about what we tried to do here was balance making the didactic point about what is vicarious traumatization with having part of the time just be a peaceful, therapeutic, process-oriented experience that is very unlike most business meetings that
are... Particularly in healthcare settings,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Part of how I think as a trainer is I think, okay, what are the goals? And then how do you facilitate people getting to those goals? And I think people are quite tired of talking heads, even though it's what they're used to in healthcare. They're used to the talking head expert who gives definitions and prevalent stats and epidemiology. But I'm not sure that that would have been the format that would have gotten people to look inside. I think that would have kept them in their head a lot. I think they would have intellectually understood the concept. I'm not sure they would have connected with it on a gut emotional level. And so part of my strategy here was, in a non-threatening way, how do I invite people to look inside? And that's how we came up with some of the activities that really elicit content from people's lived experience as opposed to their cognitive headset.
Right. And I think that was very successful. People really enjoyed looking inside, looking at how their work had affected them, how their work with trauma clients had affected them. Mm-hmm. And I think that getting through all the slides in this training is sort of not the key point, but rather giving some people space, which is so rare that we have a sense of spaciousness in a busy healthcare setting. Giving people the space to process some of their own emotions, I think, was really important. One aspect of the training that seemed to work really well was the mindfulness exercise, and I was wondering if you could describe that a little bit more.
Sure. The training would begin with me discussing who I was and why I was there, going through the two or three goals that I just discussed, and also going through the definition of vicarious trauma. And then within 5 or 7 minutes, then I would move people right into a guided imagery type of experience where they could sort of imagine a few things and see what came up. And so one of the ways that this worked, I think, really well is by giving the audience the instruction that they can participate on whatever level they're comfortable. They can withhold or not participate, or they can participate fully. And also letting them know that after the meditation, they were going to have 3 to 5 minutes of silent writing so that they knew that was coming. And that some people benefit from talking and other people don't. Audience members really felt respected if they didn't wish to talk. And if they did wish to talk, they also felt respected. So those were some good instructions. But essentially what I did then is I introduced people to a relaxed state where they were present in their body and were breathing deeply and could sort of reach a little bit more of a relaxed state. And I asked them to think back to the time that they became a public health caregiver, who they were, what their life was like, what their original hopes and intentions and passions were, and just to feel what it felt like back then and notice that without judging. And I kept them there for a minute or two with some silence. And then I asked them to consider, since they'd been public health caregiving, what's it been like with them to work with traumatized patients? What has that felt like in their body? How has that affected their heart? How has that affected their mind? How is their spirit? And kept them there. And then I sort of brought them back into the room and then gave them a few minutes to journal. And people really used the few minutes just to journal images, feelings, discrepancies they noted between how they originally entered the work and where they were at with it now, questions, concerns, fears, and hopes too. And the rest of the training essentially capitalized on their content to discuss the topic of vicarious trauma.
I think that was really beautiful how you created such a safe space for each person, regardless of how they wanted to process or didn't want to process the material. I think that allowed people to go deeply into how they felt, but not feel nervous or pressured to share with others if they didn't feel comfortable sharing at that time.
Yeah, it's so important if you're going to ask people to open up.
Right.
That you give them permission to stay closed or to open only partially, especially since it's a busy day and right. They have to go back to serving patients and they may not feel safe with other clinic members depending on what's happening at the clinic. And so these are the real world parameters
right.
of trying to work with that. And so giving lots of permission and letting people, trusting people to figure out the level of participation that made optimal sense for them.
So our hope is that clinics will actually try implementing this curriculum at their setting and see how it goes and mm-hmm. give us feedback on how it goes. So we would like to describe what elements are on the website for people to use in adapting and making this training their own for the website. All the elements that you need to create the training are on the website. Perhaps I'll go through the items with you. Item one is actually a full-day workshop that we did mm-hmm. to train trainers on how to deliver the one-hour training.
That's right.
This is not the one-hour training itself, but instead is a full-day workshop on how people can deal with all the difficult types of situations that might come up in a one-hour training, mm-hmm. lots of activities to brainstorm about what to do with difficult situations, mm-hmm. and some inspiration for the trainers.
That's right.
Perhaps you could describe item two.
Sure. Item two are sort of annotated notes for when you're leading the one-hour training. It's just sort of a nice outline of the steps that you would follow. It provides you kind of a brief overview of all the different training points. And I think it's just a much more redacted version of item one that you can just pull out and use to guide your planning for when you're facilitating a vicarious trauma-related training.
Right. Of course, you wouldn't need to have a full day train the trainer curriculum if you're not training a lot of trainers, but we just thought that if in case you want to train a lot of trainers, the full day curriculum was very useful.
Yes.
But you could just start with item two and go ahead and do the training.
Yeah. Can I say one thing about curriculums,
yes.
which is I believe the best teachers and facilitators bring curriculum to life through amending or editing or bringing their best self to it. So I will also say that even though we created this, the person who's doing it needs to select out the things that keep it still toward the goals. But I sort of invite people to make it their own.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes it fun, to make it your own.
Right, and maybe we'll end on that after we describe the other items. You can describe some of the ways you made it your own, because you really did that in a special way.
Okay.
So item three.
Item three is the PowerPoint. It's basically several slides that explain or give visuals to the key portions of the training, as you mentioned. I almost never went through the slides, but they were available. People would glance at that, and at the end, they would often ask questions. It's sort of informational, the cognitive piece that mm-hmm. people can have in front of them. Item four was really fun to write, actually. It's just a tip sheet. It's got 10 tips for caregivers. And basically, I interviewed the team at the Trauma Recovery Center, the team of social workers, psychologists, research assistants, and our reception staff as well, about the things that they did that allowed them to keep doing this work, to feel inspired while you're doing the work, not just to do it and be able to survive it, but rather to feel inspired. And so we brainstormed together a list of the 10, this created the 10 tip sheets. These are things that people who thrive doing really difficult work often choose to do for themselves. And so it's a nice little one-page tip sheet. Again, we never reviewed this in the training. We usually did not have time. However, many people would glance over it and they would ask questions about it. It's just sort of a takeaway.
Mm-hmm. And then just in case people want to have a pre-made evaluation, item five is an evaluation of the training.
Right.
So you mentioned people making the training their own, and
yes.
I feel like there were some really special ways that you made the training your own. If you could mention those briefly, that would be great.
Sure. My experience has been that when you're in the face of trauma, all that you can remember sometimes and feel is distraction and powerlessness. And whether you've been through it or whether you're helping people that have been through it or both, because many providers also have a trauma history, however remote, that calls them to the work. So for me, the opposite of destruction is creation. And the opposite of being overpowered is being inspired. And so I try to think every day, like, what are ways that I could inspire myself and those around me in small ways to be creative or to author a difficult story, but nonetheless to have it end with some creativity. So I would always try to infuse the training with creativity at the end. And I varied it just so I don't get bored. And I often brought several different formats, but there were some clinics where it felt right to share a poem. And I had a couple of poems. One is a Mary Oliver poem. Tony Hoagland actually wrote the other poem. But just a brief poem about nature or creativity or inspiration. And I would share it and we would read it together. And people would often just sit with the poem. And it's sort of like just a nice reminder that there's art out there that hurt people are creating. Sometimes I would end with a song. And again, I would often go from intuition, and I brought my iPod and little speakers, and there's certain songs that evoke feelings of hope. One of them is Desiree's song, Gotta Be. And I would play that song or just another song that I felt might touch people. And then sometimes I would bring little objects for people to take with them. Sometimes it was a little bouncy ball to remind them of their ability to bounce back. Sometimes it was a river-worn stone, with the idea that rivers do wear away stone, but they actually create greater smoothness. And it's sort of a creative process that leads to smoothness and reminding that even though the work wears at you, it can smooth you out. It can take off your rough edges. So just little images. And the one that I think that you liked the best was sharing a personal story. I have a child who has a vascular problem on one leg that he was born with. And we went through medical specialist after MRI to look at surgical interventions and all these little interventions that would help him basically have a more normal circulation in his leg. And after a year of all that, what they did is they just gave him a little compression stocking that fits around his leg and gives it a little extra squeeze, and it helps shore up the vein. And so part of what I would do at some trainings is I would just give out a piece of the cloth that his compression stocking is made of, with the idea that all his veins need is just a little lift here and there. They don't need complete realignment. They just need a little support at the right time and the right place. It's sort of a reminder that we are each other's compression stocking in workplaces, and we can decompress on each other, which is not so good, or just help kind of compress each other so that we can do our best possible work. So looking for little symbols and stories that inspire, that create, that allow people to feel hope, really, really important.
I'm so delighted that we could talk with you today, Greg, because you have supported and inspired us, and you supported and inspired so many providers through this year of providing these trainings. So thank you.
Thank you. And I feel the same exact degree of being blessed. So thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you have any feedback or you'd like to share ideas for future episodes of this podcast, please email us at info@leapsf.org. And for further information about the vicarious traumatization training, please visit our website at www.leapsf.org. I'm Lee Kimberg, here with Greg Merrill, and we thank you so much for listening.